Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Esperanza Brizuela Garcia, and today I will be talking to Dr. Kali Kananoya about his book, Healing Knowledge in Atlantic Africa, Medical Encounters, 1500 to 1850, published by Cambridge University Press in 2021. Dr. Kananoya is lecturer in science and ideas at the University of Owula. Dr. Kananoya, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Esperanza.
I wonder if you could begin this interview by you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I'm now based at the University of Oulu in northern Finland. But I began my studies at the University of Helsinki in 1999 and went to major in African studies, which in Helsinki is very much geared towards linguistic rather than cultural studies. So as part of my early training, I started learning Kiswahili, but began to drift towards African history very early in my studies. However, one of my teachers in Swahili was a former missionary and theologian named Raimo Harjula, who had worked in Tanzania in the 1970s and had also worked on medical anthropology, conducting a study on an individual herbalist. So this was published as a book with the title Mirao and His Practice in 1980. And as a student, I picked up this book and read it with curiosity, but it didn't really spark anything in me at that time. It was like my first exposure to medicine in Africa. So the topic might have been too foreign and difficult for me to really enjoy it. However, I think it probably planted some seeds within me. And gradually, as I drifted more towards studying African spiritual practices and their history, Harjula's work became quite a big influence for me. Another key piece of literature that inspired me after finishing my MA studies was James Weed's Recreating Africa, which I remember reading when I was contemplating whether to continue for a PhD. So that book, along with Linda Haywood's edited volume on the Central African diaspora, started me on a very different path and took me to study Central Africans in 18th century Brazil, very much focusing on ethnic identities and their transformations, as well as religious practices. So as you can probably imagine, African history is a very marginal subject in Finland, although we have strong historical connections with Southwest Africa, with Namibia, and to a lesser extent with Tanzania. But the academic scene is in African history is limited to about a dozen or maybe 15 scholars, and that's already counting the current PhD students and postdocs. But I was very lucky to always have good teachers, good mentors, now colleagues, people like Holger Weiss, Juhani Koponen, Harri Siiskonen and Markku Hokkanen, who showed me how African history is done and who all published at a high international level and pushed me to do the same. And who also continue to contribute to the relevant discussions in our field. So that was always very inspirational, very supportive, and also facilitated my work on the book we're going to talk about today, Healing Knowledge in Atlantic Africa.
How specifically did you come to work on this book? When did it start taking shape in first in your head, and then how did it start to happen?
Right. So I finished my PhD in 2012, so 9 years ago, and then spent a year at the European University Institute in Florence in Italy. But then I received a three-year grant from the Academy of Finland to work solely on this project, and had another year of funding from the Helsinki Collegium of Advanced Study, which of course all this generous support helped me to conduct archival research, and ended up spending several months in Portugal to research this book. So that was of course the first step to have that funding in place. But intellectually, I mean, I was very inspired, like I said, James Wheat, and inspired by this whole historiography on African healing practices in the Americas. And at the same time, I was very frustrated about how little all the scholarship had to say about Africa and medicine in Africa, and how even some of the best studies that set out to write about these topics using an Atlantic history framework didn't really focus on Africa at all. There were exceptions, of course, and sure, I had read John Thornton's African Africans in the Making of the Atlantic World, as well as James Wheat's second book about Domingos Alvarez. But even those two books took the narrative out of Africa, whereas in my own book, I wanted the focus to remain only on the African continent. So partially I was writing in reaction to the developments that were taking place in the much larger fields of American and Atlantic, as well as African diaspora history, and how healing and health and medicine were being taken seriously by scholars in these fields. At the same time, I was also going against the grain in pre-colonial African history, where the narrative was always super focused on the Atlantic slave trade and enslavement of Africans. And now, of course, I'm not saying that slavery shouldn't be a focus area of African history, but personally, I wanted to experiment whether I can write about this period in global history and about these parts of the world without putting the African experiences of enslavement at the center. Also, during my PhD research on slavery in Brazil, I had started gathering material on Angola and Congo in Portuguese archives. So mainly in the overseas archives, Arquivo Histórico Ultramarino, and the Portuguese National Archives in Torre do Tombo, where I worked mostly on the Inquisitional records. So I had a hunch of the materials that I could expect to find there and that were needed for the study, and I had already transcribed or digitalized some sources that offered material for writing about health and medicine in African history. So that's how I was able to sell the project to the funding agencies. Although I couldn't be really sure that in the end I would end up with enough material for a book-length study. As I dug deeper in this topic, however, I also discovered that quite a few Portuguese scholars had also written about topics related to medicine and disease. So this appeared in obscure articles in all kinds of colonial journals and bulletins during the first half of the 20th century. And that helped me as well in locating more materials and build a bigger picture out of this very sporadic and sketchy documentation.
One thing that as I was reading through the book, I was wondering whether it was in those early sources, in those early Inquisition sources, where you started to, the main argument in your book, you know, the existence of this crossover and this ultimately this kind of hybridization of medical practices. In a way, it's also quite. It's not necessarily something that I think. I should have expected it, but I've never seen it actually written down or like demonstrated and illustrated in the way that you did it. And I was wondering whether it was a reading those Inquisition sources that you first started to get a sense that, you know, that this was the case in the first place, but also that you could be able to show it, you know, to write, if not even a whole book, but just to sustain an argument around along those lines.
Yeah, it was very evident in those Inquisition sources that the same thing happened in Brazil, of course, that there were always these Portuguese men, because they were usually men who went as soldiers and officers to Angola. So very often it was the case that the Portuguese men were using the services, if we can say that, the services of African healers, and there was always this cross-cultural interaction. So in the rituals you could see evidence that it was Europeans and Africans together who participated in these rituals. So that kind of medical pluralism, not only in the sense that African healing practices themselves were plural, so you had many kinds of different kinds of specialists doing all sorts of healing, and then also sorts of European practitioners who fumbled around on the African continent and tried to figure out a way to health, so to speak. But of course, these, you know, the methodological issues were huge in trying to tease out the presence and the actual powers of African healers. I mean, for the most part, the Portuguese sources remain silent on issues of health and healing. Healers have an almost invisible presence in this creolized or hybridized landscapes of Angola. So they are usually present only when there's some sort of a clash of cultures. So when someone judges them and their practice. And here, of course, the Inquisition trials and denunciations, which paradoxically, despite all these biases, still remain the best sources we have on African healers and healing in the early modern world. But this is, of course, a conceptual problem in that the Portuguese very rarely refer to African healers as healers, you know, using the Portuguese word curandeiro. Mm-hmm. So they are mostly referred to as feiticeiros, feiticeiras. Which to the English and the Dutch in West Africa would translate as the fetish men. So that is someone who uses power objects or harnesses these spiritual entities to either heal or to harm others. So the obvious issue here the methodological issue here is that Africans very rarely in these sources get to present their own point of view. They are usually presented in negative light by authorities who condemn their practice. Then there's also, I use a lot of the Italian Capuchin materials, which complement the Inquisition sources. And there we can see these glimpses of the internal pluralism of African medicine. Like I have in one of the chapters, I have a list of healer titles compiled by the Capuchin Cavazzi in the 17th century. So we have healers such as the Shingilas, who specialize in healing by spirit possession, then others who prepared and sold different types of talismans and medicines to ailing patients. So while it's still biased and judgmental, it's also, you know, the Capuchins were at least attempting to understand how the medical marketplace, if we want to use that expression, functioned in Central Africa. And then we can go on to contrast that list by Cavazzi with another type of typology, which was drawn up by the missionary Giuseppe Monari. So where he put the Central African healers into, you know, the three categories: the good, the wicked, and the bad. And the good are the ones who relied on, you know, the good healers rely only on herbal medicine and medicinal roots. And Monari also thinks that they are a little bit like the surgeons. He actually uses the word surgeon to describe these healers, the herbalists. But then we have others who use not only herbs, but also rely on these superstitious, what Monari calls the superstitious words, incantations. So mixed herbal and spiritual practice. And then we had the bad healers who only healed by spirit possession and you know, tried to keep this ritual secret. So, you know, methodologically, again, this kind of moral taxonomy doesn't help us get very far. But I think it's helpful for understanding that early modern observers who were outsiders to African societies also realized these, you know, the basic divisions and the basic medical plurality, you know, that African societies were medically plural societies, where different kinds of healers compete, you know, they competed with each other, but also complemented each other.
Mm-hmm. You spend your first chapter sort of like detailing this plurality. And in a way, it like you said, it also helps us understand sort of like the understand the conception of disease, you know, what you make this general distinction between diseases of the body, physical diseases, and the ones that were dealt with more specifically, or diseases of human or man, or social diseases that tended to be dealt more like with the spiritual healers, or, you know, there wasn't like always a clear distinction, but it's interesting how that through the understanding of the different of this pluralism, it also gives us an entry into how they understood ailments and different kinds of ailments and among Africans. But what I think is particularly insightful in your study is as you follow it through, you start showing how partly one of the reasons why the Portuguese, especially in Central Africa, were able to perceive this is because it was not so alien to them. You know, they themselves in early modern Europe itself, this conceptualization of disease was not so far out from what they had experienced themselves. Could you start tell us a little bit about how you came to that insight and how that became apparent to you.
Yeah, of course, I'm not the first one to suggest it.
Yeah, I know.
So others before me have written about the Portuguese, and of course the Portuguese themselves, in Portugal already had Inquisition, and you have the same kind of medical pluralism also in Portugal. So mm-hmm. So I think it was only natural, and I think in that sense it's also very important that for pre-colonial Africa that we also try to connect it to historiographies in other fields, like it's been done in Atlantic history now, but we also have to be aware of these developments in American and European history, and that's really what I was trying to do throughout the book, that I was trying to combine all these different historiographies and see whether to me it often seems that Finnish society or not only early modern Africa and early modern Finland are similar in many ways, but also for later periods, and how the development of human societies goes through these stages, and sometimes one society is 20 or 30 years before the others, but it seems to me that many of these lines can be found throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and again, I think one of the interesting, sort of emphasis, I think, in the book is a more balanced approach to between difference and common ground, in the sense that there's a good an attempt to understand not only a lot of times, like you said, in the cross-cultural encounter, it focuses in areas of conflict in which the emphasis is on what make these two groups or what made these two cultures different, and obviously there's some of that, and especially in the Inquisition cases, of course, but. What I liked about your book is that you balance it really well with very compelling arguments about the existence of this common ground and in some ways why, and also the historicity of this common ground in the sense like in your second chapter, for instance, you move into just the specificity of this, of the materials that were used, the remedies, the specific things that were used and how some of them were adopted by Portuguese, how Africans themselves were curious about European remedies, etc. There was this pragmatism about, what each of them could use. But of course, this in both cases, there was experimentation. There was trying things out. And so again, it sort of shows that even this level of communication could not have taken place without a sense of both cultures or all these different cultures giving a certain amount of value to this particular type of materials and knowledge. And I think that's, again, that's a balance that we often do not find in a lot of studies that look at cross-cultural encounters.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting, in the second chapter when we turn to questions of materiality of medicine. So the sources I use, the overall tone is much more positive, mm-hmm. in a way that there's much less condemnation and it shows more the curiosity of the different sides of these exchanges. So the principal issue here, of course, is that Africans and Europeans both had to find ways to survive somehow. So what do you do when your own medicine fails or isn't available to you to start with? So you always turn to the local ingredients, local resources, at first this is a matter of survival. And in Atlantic Africa, it doesn't really or didn't really develop into an economic alternative until in the 20th century. But the Portuguese started to envision this medicinal trade as an alternative to the slave trade already in the late 18th century. So then we can also go on to ask why the African medicinals didn't arouse the same excitement in Europe in the 17th and 18th century, but remain very marginal compared to the interest in Asian and American medicines. And I think the simple answer here is that there's a lack of direct contact between Africa, you know, going from Africa directly to Europe in this period. So we have all the ships are sailing from Africa to the Americas and also taking parts of this medicinal knowledge from Africa to the Americas, but not to Europe. So they are African medicinals were constantly becoming more popular as Londa Sheeping and others have shown. So more popular in the Americas than in Europe. And then this another Atlantic crossing from America to Europe wasn't happening systematically. Or the African medicinals from the Americas did not go to Europe. And then there's also, you know, as I demonstrated there, that the lack of overall scientific interest in Africa in the early modern period. So all the people who made these early modern collections of African medicinal materials compiled this knowledge into manuscripts. So they were at best, they were amateur botanists. We have very good listings of Central African medicines that I showed there in the second chapter. One of these soldiers was a Portuguese soldier, Afonso Mendes, around 1650, compiled this knowledge without explaining how he gathered it. So I would speculate that he learned about it, maybe bought it from African soldiers, possibly healers in the interior of Angola. And many other similar listings, you know, from the Capuchin missionaries. What I found very interesting when looking at all these lists over time, you know, from the late 16th through the 17th to the 18th century, was that certain medicinal plants were repeated over and over again. We have stuff like plants like Takula, Kikongo, Engariaria that remained in very popular use in Central Africa throughout the period, had strong continuities. And sometimes, you know, their specific use is changed, but so they might have been used for different diseases and ailments at different times. But we can be positive that there was a constant market for these materials, right? Mm-hmm. It was not necessarily an export market that we can trace statistically. But certainly these local networks, regional networks, were highly organized and medicinals also moved around the place in these trading networks.
Mm-hmm. Chapters, the next couple of chapters, I was interested in how you try to sort of like move away from or try to sort of see if you could generalize test your thesis into other areas of Atlantic Africa. And so you in the first chapter you talk about the Gold Coast, and then in three, and then in four you look at Sierra Leone, and in some ways they do of course you know add other dimensions to the story that you're telling. And particularly in the case of Sierra Leone, it's not even just a geographic thing, but it's also like it advances the story a little bit further chronologically. And it does help illustrate sort of the how and when like the changing attitudes of Europeans towards Africans in general also have an impact in the way in which these medicinals are seen by Europeans. Could you tell us a little bit, how did you decide that you wanted or needed to find examples in other parts of Atlantic Africa? Was this very hard? Did you have any idea that these materials existed? And then how did you go about integrating your findings into the book?
Yeah, so this, you know, the chapters on the Gold Coast and Sierra Leone, I wrote them originally as one chapter and then decided to split them when I was finishing the book. And really, both chapters started with a very good question at a conference by Mariana Candido. Mm-hmm. So who asked me that, you know, Kalle, at the end of the day, were the Portuguese really any different from other Europeans who were active in West Africa? And, you know, especially in medical matters. And of course, at the time, I didn't have an answer, but I decided to go for it and look for at least some kind of tentative answer. And overall, I think it's a question that historians of that type of question is something that historians of pre-colonial Africa need to ask more often. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have this, you know, between regions, we have all kinds of political and religious differences. You know, the dynamics of colonization were not identical in Angola and the Gold Coast and Sierra Leone. But in matters of health and medicine, I think, you know, it boiled down to these very basic questions of daily survival. And as was the case in Angola, I think African women played very important roles, not only as providers of care and providers of simple herbal medicines, but also as go-betweens in facilitating Europeans' access to more established healers in more serious cases of illness. So, you know, in these chapters, I also wanted to push against this idea of history as a nationalistic science and think that for Atlantic Africa, you know, our source base needs to represent the various groups that were present on the coast. So that's why I decided to bring not only the British, but also, you know, Dutch and Danish materials from the Gold Coast, as well as bits of Swedish material for Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I do this exhaustively, and I'm sure others can take this forward and study the archives in much more detail than I did for West Africa. And if anything, I hope that these, you know, the chapters will inspire others to work on these topics for West Africa.
Mm-hmm. Do you, in terms of the, you know, how they, it, like you're saying, in a way that it in answer to that original question that was posed to you, again, it sort of shows that regardless of the, you know, the particular nation or company that was supporting each of these colonization ventures, the ultimate need to survive in these environments was important. I mean, was more prominent and was really behind the interest in this medical findings. And ultimately, I think what was also very interesting here and is the use of sort of these interpreters, like either in the case of the Gold Coast, when you talk about like women and like the clear presence of women and in the case of Sierra Leone, this particular interpreters, informants that you mentioned, sort of mysterious figures that we hear some names for them, but we don't actually know who they are. It's, again, it's such an interesting way, or I think it adds a lot to this understanding that there, even though there's all of these sources come from Europeans, if we read them carefully and the way that to read them is to understand that they're somehow transcribing these voices, these African voices. And in that regard, like the understanding of the differences of these different Europeans interlocutors also helps us be more careful readers of these African voices. And I was wondering how you navigated that. You know, obviously you spent many, many years deep in the Portuguese sources. Did you find having to change, how difficult was it to change to all of a sudden having to read the Swedish or Dutch or English sources as a means to try to understand what these African voices were, you know, the tone or the information that these African sources were providing?
Yeah, that part wasn't so difficult. I remember one of the courses I took as a student in Helsinki was so we had a course on the Nordic or the Scandinavian presence in Africa. So I was already a little bit familiar with the context and also with some of the sources. It was very difficult, you know, to find and as you said, the African voice in those European sources is very difficult. So we have this, for example, in the Cold Coast, in the Danish sources, I found these mentions that Africans were acquiring European medical techniques, or they were acquiring medicines from the slave ports and ships. But these are very, very sketchy mentions. And what was interesting was that, you know, at times it seemed that the Africans were more interested in experimenting with the European than the Europeans were using their own medicine in a way that, you know, in many of these sources, you know, so the Europeans are very skeptical about their own surgeons and about their own barbers, but mm-hmm. Africans then for one reason or another decide that it might be a good idea to, you know, and it's, again, it boils down to this, you know, the idea of pluralism, that if something doesn't work, then you try to find something else that might work, you know, something else that might offer the cure. Mm-hmm. Again, comparatively speaking, we don't have the same kind of rich botanical descriptions for West Africa that the Capuchins were producing in the Kingdom of Congo. And we also don't have the same kind of these amateur pharmacopoeias which can provide information on Angolan medicinals. But even for the Cold Coast, I found that I can take the material approach, and I'm sure that if anyone follows these trails in the British archives, for example, they will find much more evidence than I was able to cover. Mm-hmm. And the case of Sierra Leone, again, interesting from the comparative perspective, because, you know, as you said about the chronology, it's a later development, and we can see these synchronous developments in Angola. So when it comes to scientific and natural historical interest of Africa, and of course this has to do with the Linnaean systematization and the Linnaean networks that sought to catalog the natural resources and the animals and the plants on a global scale. Mm-hmm. So we have all these Linnaeus disciples, Linnaeus apostles roaming these extra-European landscapes. We have people like Sparrman, Anders Sparrman in South Africa and Thunberg in the Far East. And finally, Adam Afzelius in Sierra Leone, mm-hmm. who's actually part of the Banksian networks, you know, part of the English or the British networks and working for and sponsored by the company in Sierra Leone. So mostly, you know, Afzelius in Freetown, he sits, you know, when you read his journal, it seems that Afzelius sits in a hut in Freetown, and he has all these local assistants. You know, the locals are bringing him specimen, and he does the classifying. He sits there and proceeds to classify these plants and goes on to document their local uses and local names if the informants can tell them. And he shows that, you know, the journal shows that two of these assistants, especially two which I focus more on, are trusted servants, do most of the collecting. And we only know them by their servant names, so Peter and Duffa. And despite, you know, this constant, you know, daily interactions, Afzelius doesn't, or at least the part of the journal that survives, doesn't give any clues to their identity, you know, the African identities of these men. So, for example, we don't know their original names. I suspect the names that are used were given by Afzelius himself. Nevertheless, combining all these descriptions, we can again see the widespread and very common reliance on African sources of healing, African healing practices in the Atlantic spaces.
Now that you just mentioned that you started your training in linguistics, it sort of explains also a lot that the use that you make of just words, you know, the linguistic, it just provides like a nice sort of grounding source for some of the work that you do. And I figured it also might have helped in grounding the ideas of, you know, change and pluralism into this area. And I imagine, like you also said, the reading of all these different diverse sources, even in European languages. And moving a little bit more to that, your next couple of chapters deal precisely with sort of like the European side, you know, the introduction of Portuguese or European pluralism in Africa, and where are some of the examples that we see of this. And in these chapters, I felt that it was interesting to think about your idea of African, you know, you mentioned that it is not easy to trace changes in African medical practice precisely because the sources are not as rich as we would like them to be. But despite that, I think you're able to suggest that these are not, and I like that. And often in the book, you talk about, you use the word traditional and quotation marks, so as to say, you know, let's not think about this something as a closed system. You know, this was obviously a dynamic system. So can you tell us a little bit about how in these two chapters you now fit in how European practices or practices that were coming from the Atlantic world try to fit in and modify or affect African medical practice as you describe it?
Yeah, it's again, I think it's a very interesting question, because then we go to another type of source. And we can, what I used a lot in the book were these, or in these chapters, were the, you know, the Portuguese censuses for West Central Africa. So all these, for example, all the, and, you know, statistics for medicinals that were traded into Luanda. So I show there that, you know, the cinchona bark was arriving from Brazil throughout the 18th century, and in more extensive numbers in the early 19th century. So we have that very long history of of these materials, you know, American materials being used also in Africa, which hasn't really been paid attention to before. And then in the censuses, we have the, I showed the presence of these African barbers, you know, trained by the Portuguese, but really barber surgeons who are not only present on the coast in Luanda and in Benguela, but also a practice, you know, European medical practice that was also spreading to the interior. And you know, we can see traces of that in the 19th century, you know, when Portuguese travelers go to the interior of Africa, they realize that, you know, these barbers are already here. You know, they can offer us something that we are familiar with. But I also want to say another thing, one more thing about the linguistic sources and the linguistic materials or the, you know, this kind of tracing a word. And I have I think it's in the sixth chapter, maybe, I talk about this African melancholy, or this, you know, the disease of Banzo.
Yes.
Which is very intriguing because, you know, it often I would only have the one word, you know, I would have the word, but I would have no explanation in the sources. And the explanations for the word or the medical the medical idea and explanation emerged much later in the sources than the idea of this disease. So it has a, you know, it seems that all the people who are using the word know exactly what it means already, you know, already in the late 17th century. But then the first physician to write about the Banzo disease comes in the 1760s or so. And it seems that the idea of this disease was very, very common, you know, it was shared by Central Africans and the Portuguese. You know, the word comes from the Bantu word Banza, meaning home or village. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a description of how this disease concept emerged, but I would speculate that it was coined when the slaves were marched to the coast and taken to the slave ships, and they were crying out this word Banza, and the Portuguese take it and they make a verb out of it. So they start calling this ailment banzar. So they are saying that someone is banzando, literally someone is suffering from banza, suffering from this intense longing for home. And we can use the modern word depression. We can talk about melancholia, but if we want to find out what the people in the 17th or the 18th century thought about it, we also need to think about this etymology and understand that at the root of this word is homesickness. And that, of course, is something that anyone can suffer from, you know, black or white can suffer from Banza. And the Portuguese did also suffer from it, according. You know, sometimes they write that someone is ill because they have the Banzo. But what happens when the physician Damião Cosme writes about this in the 1760s, then we can see that this concept has really, it has become racialized, in the sense that all of a sudden it's not the white people anymore who suffer from it, but now it's only the blacks who have the who can have this illness, begins to be classified as a disease of the blacks, right? The concept becomes racialized. And this, from this time onward, you know, medical doctors also begin to pay more attention to Banzo and similar mental ailments, not only in Africa, but also among slave populations in the New World. And I think that's one of the most important examples of why this kind of, you know, why we need to pay attention to the linguistic size and, you know, the historical linguistic. I wish I could do more of it and and would have the, you know, the proper, you know, the time and the proper skills to do it in a much greater detail.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, like I said, I found it very grounding, and I thought it was a good place to start in the places where you used it. And you finished your with the last chapter talking about a medical geography, and you know you have started from the very start. One of the recurrent characteristics of this pluralism, particularly the African pluralism, is that it's very mobile, and it's sort of that these medical healers and professionals, basically they just move around quite significantly. But in this chapter, you sort of, it's in a little bit, it's a little bit of a follow-up to the six, you know, where you talk about the limitations of the humor system of medicine, and in a way the importance that was eventually given to this notion of the environment as being like the most important determinant of the ability to stay healthy or to cure disease, et cetera, et cetera. And but in a way also this chapter I felt helps finally find like what was the final place that was given to all this knowledge, you know, that was accumulated about Africa, and this kind of sort of tension between how in some ways this knowledge proved to be so useful even when it came to be known in sort of European circles, but in a way also retain this level of being useful in a specific locality. Can you tell us a little bit about how this chapter came to be and conclude your basically encapsulate your conclusions from the rest of the book?
Yeah. So how geographical space, environment, and health were conceptualized not only in Central Africa but also in the Portuguese. I tried to write about how it's conceptualized in the Portuguese Atlantic at large. And I, you know, maybe conceptualization is not even a good word here, because I think it's more about imagination. In the end, it's more about imagination and images that became attached to certain locations and certain regions over the centuries. And this was the part where it was the most hardest to discover if these images, to what extent these images were shared between Africans and the Portuguese. So in contrast to the sharing of medicinals and disease concepts, here the Europeans might have been building up their own set of rules in a way, instead of eagerly going to local informants to learn about healthy and healing versus diseased and dangerous environments. And we have to factor all these adaptations and migrations that for the African side that had already taken place. You know, they, you know, the local population had been there for centuries and millennia before the Europeans arrived. So this probably was very developed, you know, had already been developed among the locals, and the Europeans with the different background had to go through those adaptations and in the end adapted very poorly to the new environment that they encountered. I think the basic or the important point here to note is that there emerged this clear division of the land or the environment. So we have this idea of the healthy coast or the littoral, and then the very dangerous and disease-ridden interior. You know, interior was always more harmful and more dangerous. And if you wanted to recuperate from illness, you had to seek treatment on the coast. And as I conclude that, you know, the Europeans often didn't have any other option but to go away from Angola, you know, seek out a cure in Brazil or go travel back to Europe. And this type of, you know, again, talking about these continuities in the longue durée, it's very interesting to note that this type of traveling for health causes, of course, was also very typical for Europeans in colonial Africa, you know, in a later period. So one of the questions for further research would be to look at this, you know, to what extent these early modern imaginations carried on to later times.
Mm. Well, I mean, in some ways, even at really later times, I mean, it is still a common trope. I mean, I remember, at least in Mexico, you know, that my grandmother saying things like that. You know, it's like, oh, what you need is some time at the beach, and you'll be fine. Or, you know, like always, the coastal areas were more, you know, maybe not necessarily salubrious, but at least that the sea, the air of the sea and the water, the seawater was always had some kind of healing qualities, as opposed to wherever you happen to be. So right. I thought that was, it's like you said, it's like this things that we don't necessarily know where they come from, but somehow they persist. You conclude, I find the conclusion is really interesting because, you know, you spend quite a bit of time talking about all the methodological challenges that you basically want to make sure we all are aware of. And regardless in light of those, I seem to feel like you feel like there's a lot of, like you said, what you said about those two chapters, you know, that you still feel there's quite a bit of work that can be done with regard to some of these problems, not just in the Gold Coast or Sierra Leone in regards with this question. But more importantly, I think your concept of pluralism and the importance of sort of realizing the contributions of both Europeans and Africans to this world of medical intervention and medical ideas in this world is something that, you know, yet needs, despite the challenges in the documentation, there's still a lot of room to think about these questions. Can you tell us a little bit, how do you see things moving forward, whether in your own research or where do you see valuable avenues for people to explore in this arena?
Yeah, what I really didn't do in the book, which I think is a really important question, is you know, I end the story in the first half of the 19th century. And I think it's really important to look what comes next. I mean, I think a lot of the, and the historiography has already shown that, you know, a lot of things changed, you know, as medical technologies developed in the 19th and the 20th century. So, I think it would be very important to carry, and I would like to also do it for Angola, you know, to carry this research further in time, you know, closer to our day, and see what happened after 1850 and how all these ideas of you know, the, like the idea of the witch doctor in colonial Africa emerged, and you know, all these discourses on the other continue to develop. And, you know, took this also, I think, take this story that I was trying to tell, they also take it to another direction. So I mentioned in the beginning about this the Finnish connection in Namibia, mm-hmm. and that's something I began to work on, particularly the Finnish medical mission in Southwest Africa in the early 20th century. And of course, coronavirus messed with my plans to travel to Namibia, but we have to see how that project evolves mm-hmm. in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking a lot about this because, I mean, like you mentioned, even in your book, this idea of Africa having not been, colonized to the extent, for instance, that the Americans were colonized earlier, precisely because of, you know, the amount of disease that Europeans would suffer when they enter some of African environments. And in a way, this notion that this didn't happen, like full-fledged colonization didn't happen until the 19th century when European technology was able to support a more sustained colonial project. And how how your book, in a way, sort of makes us think a little bit more carefully about that narrative, isn't it? That maybe it makes us forget that Europeans might have struggled a little bit, but in many of these areas, they did manage to figure out ways to live and to survive, and they did so precisely because they took advantage of the knowledge that already existed on the ground. And not only that, but that said knowledge contributed to broader traditions of medical understanding. In other words, that the Europeans were not the only ones who had cracked the nut of how to survive in Africa. Right. Africans had done it long before that. So yeah, it definitely made me sort of rethink a couple of things that I'd say in my lectures. When I teach, so thank you for that. I think I've taken quite a bit of your time. Would you like to tell us a little bit what you're working on? Is it just this pod project on the Finnish medical mission, or is there anything else on the works?
Yeah, as I said in the beginning, so the African history crew in Finland it's a small community, and I also feel that we have a responsibility to engage with the larger public here and show how and why African history matters. So I'm working with some of my colleagues on a book or synthesis about demography and health in African history. Mm-hmm. Of course, not relevant to the international listeners out there, but at the same time, it's something I hope more Africanist scholars would take up and think about how to center the African experience and make it relevant so that it speaks to a larger public and to readers and viewers and listeners, whichever mm-hmm. medium you choose to use.
Yep, I agree. I couldn't agree more with that. both of those projects sound like great too, and we will be looking forward to them. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the book, so thank you for the book too. Take care, and we hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you, Esperanza.